So, hello dear people. This is the Possibilist in English. First time, because Tom made me doing this. thank you for that, Tom, for encouraging that I do the jump to your 9 hours behind time zone. And so good morning there. And also good morning to everyone, or good evening to everyone in Europe. So hi, Tom. Nice to have you.
Thanks, Florian. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
So this is really a LinkedIn story, because without LinkedIn, we wouldn't be connected. And we just like our posts. The most, I like the posts about when you're rumbling with you as a man and with you as a partly Native American, which is a story in itself. So where would you like to start? So who is Tom, and why are two men fighting in one? Maybe we start there.
Okay. Thank you again, Florian, for having me on your show. I think the intrigue has always been, when I came across your profile and I saw the pirate, and then I had the cowboy hat and I was wearing the pirate shirt, I said, there's something happening here. There's a synergy, and I got to explore this further, and get to learn a little bit about this guy over in Germany. And then when I read that you were also into Lego serious play, which truthfully I don't know much about, but I understand that it's a therapy tool that's utilized a lot in psychology, and that you also had this dream and a vision about helping to build a utopian society, I said, well, I think there's some similarities here in spiritual beliefs. Mm. So where this name comes from is, in my family, I was brought up two very patriarchal families, both of Irish and Italian ancestry, and that's how I was brought up to believe. But my Irish grandfather had married my grandmother, who claimed to be French Canadian. She was 14 and a half and he was 21. And this was back in 1927. And the reality is that there was always some murmurings that when she would have a few glasses of wine, she would say, I'm the family's little Indian. And eventually we were able to prove with genealogy that grandmother was in fact Native American. Her roots were likely from Ontario, Canada. So she would be what today they call First Nations, as opposed to Native American, because up in Canada they say First Nations. So she would have been, also another term is Métis, or a mixture of ancestry, French and Native American, likely Ojibwe or Anishinaabe people, and that either her grandfather, my great-great-grandfather, was either born up in Ontario and the family moved down to Wisconsin, or he was born in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And so when I found out about my heritage, first heard the murmurings, I was in my 20s, and I had gone to Fort Berthold, North Dakota, to learn about what they call the Red Road, which is another name for Native American spirituality. And my teacher was Tom Demaray, or High Holy Bull, and his teacher was a lady by the name of Sadie Mann, who also was one of my teachers. And I had gone out on Vision Quest or Kamplacha and had been involved in a number of ceremonies, and eventually I was given the name Madze Migi Maru Nubish, which means two men fighting in one. And so I was young, I was brash, I was arrogant, and I asked Sadie Mann, the medicine woman who gave me the name, I said, so that means I'm stronger than two men. And she said, no, she says, it's that you are two men fighting in one. And when you unite those two men, then you will be stronger than you could ever imagine. And that's part of what they call walking in the circle of life, mm-hmm. is that it's taken about 30 years and now the two men are finally coming together and as one.
And how would you describe these two men? So who's the one, who's the other, and what is like the adventure to bring them together?
Oh boy. Okay. I didn't figure you were going to ask that. Well, I guess if you were applying psychology to this, there's a term called introjects, which are those aspects from our parents that we imprint on, both good or bad. So in my case, I would say the two men fighting in one would be the adult personality, Tom, and the child personality, Tommy.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, and that has been a lifelong battle, but, you know, probably like a lot of people out there in the world, you know, just suffice to say, you know, I come from a background where my childhood was just not the best. Let's just say that.
Mm. And when you found out, you said it took decades that you found out that you have some part Native American in you. What changed then? I mean, somehow it became very important to you, as far as I can, just be part of your LinkedIn posts. And why did it get so important? I mean, you could have been the Tom from America, being arrogant, making business. Why didn't you just stay there, Tom?
Oh, okay. Are you calling me arrogant?
You said that by yourself. Yeah. No. I'm just quoting.
No, just, you know, when we're young men, you know, I think just suffice to say, generally speaking, most young men, they don't have a lot of spiritual development or wisdom yet, maturity. And we all go through that. And, you know, we've all been there. And you're absolutely correct. You know, it's part of the evolution. And so I think I might have lost track of your question, but you were asking me.
No, I'm asking you why did this become so important to you when you found out? Because now the heritage, I mean, it's like it became a core right now.
That's a really great, great question. In America, you know, this whole country is basically made up of immigrants. Except when you think about it, the original people, the first people, are Native Americans who, either depending upon the belief from which nation you belong to as a Native American or indigenous person, the belief is that either we've been here since the beginning of time or we came from the stars, and we came here from the stars. So, you know, every other wave that has come to America has been basically an immigrant, beginning with, you know, some say even before the British, some say it was the Vikings that were here first. And then some say even that before the Vikings, now there's some thought that on the West Coast, it was the Chinese. And then on the East Coast, that even before the Vikings, it was perhaps even the Scottish people. And strangely enough, when they've done DNA studies with the people that I studied with, the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara people, they all have Scottish genes. And there was an idea that some Scottish explorers made it to the East Coast, travel all the way, and then up the Mississippi River into North Dakota. And so it's very interesting. But with my heritage, every aspect of my ancestry was a people, except for my Native American roots, which were here from the beginning. Every other aspect was a people that came here after. So for example, the Irish side of my family, when, you know, there was such prejudice against Irish people that even in the 1920s, there was a song that was created, say, that was called "Irish Need Not Apply for a Job." You know, there was just a real hatred towards the Irish, but they were the working labor force. And then at the turn of the century, around the 1900s, first in the 1860s after the potato famine, the Irish came. And interestingly enough, just focusing on that for a second, the Irish have always been very, very close with Native Americans. So the Choctaw Chickasaw Nation out of Arkansas, they had actually helped to support Irish in Ireland when they were going through the potato famine by sending money and potatoes back to Ireland. And now there's a monument in County Cork, Ireland, which is where the Irish side of my family's from, that's a statue that was erected honoring Native Americans in County Cork, Ireland. And then, of course, the Italians came at the turn of the century, and they were hated, and they became the next workforce. And so what I find is very interesting is that just looking, for example, at the Irish and the Italian roots of my family, I've been subjected to prejudice on both those sides. I've been called a Mick, being Irish in not a flattering way. I've been called a Dago, a Wop, a Guinea, and even it's funny because I exist between two. I say I'm a man who exists between many worlds. My Native American brothers, we talk about the material world or the spiritual world and the material world, and we say that we walk in between. But culturally, I've always been between worlds because I've not been full Irish. And even my family has this history, which, you know, if you want to talk about post-traumatic stress disorder or transgenerational PTSD, they've been subjected to hatred for the decades that they were here until they finally made it. On the Sicilian side of my family, that part of my family was what, if you've ever seen the movie Goodfellas, we were a family. So my grandfather on the Sicilian side of the family, he was a good fella. He was a family guy. And in that world, if I wanted to go into that world, I could only go so far because of my heritage. So I would not be what they would call a made man if I wanted to go that route. So even in those two aspects of my heritage, there's not really acceptance. And then when you throw in the Native American aspect of my heritage, which has predominantly been my religion, my philosophy, my spirituality for the majority of my life, even though I was baptized Catholic, I'd probably gone to church 10 times. That's it. I always liked the pyrotechnics, you know, the incense, you know, and the chanting. I always thought that was really cool. But other than that, it really didn't do much for me. But with the Native American heritage, the funny thing that exists in this country today is that even amongst Native Americans and people who have that ancestry, there's still a lot of division. Many Native Americans still fight against or, you know, do not accept each other. There's old blood feuds that go back 100 years or so, depending upon tribes and nations. And in the modern world today, there's even an animosity and a segregationist attitude between, say, people who consider themselves full blood versus people like me who are mixed. And they say, oh, you're not Indian. Get out of here, which is really sad and unfortunate in a way, because, for example, like in African-American culture, if someone has African-American ancestry, you know, they will just, they recognize and accept those people into their lives. They say, hey man, you black, you want us, you know. But in Native American culture, there's still this ostracization and separation, which is really unfortunate. And, you know, I understand the term today, pretendian, in people who are trying to pretend to something, to be something that they're not. But those are usually people that have an agenda that are trying to gain something, like they'll make a claim either to get free college benefits or some kind of a low interest loan or something. And I've never done that. I have no interest in that. I'm still trying to find the family connection that we have up in Canada. And the way that you have to do that is very complicated in this country. And especially then when you have to cross a border to look into another country, it becomes even more complex to find your origins.
So you said 30 years you were like out of spiritualism or spirituality. Yes.
Well, I tried to, so yeah, 30. So if we're going back 30 years, originally, my first career out of college, I was a park ranger and I was a peace officer. I had gone through firefighting training, EMT training. I loved it. It was a dream job. But at that time in the late 1980s and going into the early 1990s, it didn't pay well. I mean, I had law enforcement agencies that were saying, hey, come to work for us. You know, you'll make 10 times what you're making as a ranger. But I didn't want to be a cop. That wasn't my gig. And at that time, they had the consent decree, which today might have worked for me because being part Native American, I would have been at the top of the list. But things worked out the way they did. And I had a number of spiritual experiences, a couple of near-death experiences where I literally, the first one was when I was a park ranger. We were doing a drown training drill and I died. And my body temperature had gone down to 75 degrees. So I went into cardiac arrest and literally died. I was before an archangel, literally, I guess, in heaven. And I remember arguing with Archangel Gabriel. He said, it's not your time. You got to go back. And I said, no, you don't understand. Elvis has cashed in his chips. I'm here. I'm not going anywhere. I said, I'm here. The show's over. Elvis has left the stage. And then the next thing I know, it was like being carried in the arms of a father back to Earth. Or it was the sensation of going through this gold tunnel of light. And I remember looking up at Gabriel and I said, you know, I don't want to go back. And he said in a very understanding, compassionate way, I understand, but don't worry. You'll be back here before you know it. In other words, what's our lifetime to an angel? It's not even the blinking of an eye. And so I found myself back and it was this literally like a baby being born, just this... taking a massive breath, and all of a sudden I could hear the sirens and the lights, and you know, the rangers are running around, the lifeguards are running around panicked. And I said, you guys didn't call the fire department, did you? And they said, yeah, we did. And that kind of opened up some doors, and I had become literally a faith healer, a spiritual healer. It's not me, it's Creator, God through me. And I started getting a lot of requests from people up and down the coast of California, working at that time with people predominantly who had cancer, and they would get better. And so, like I say, I was at that time living in the San Francisco Bay Area and going into the dot-com revolution of the early 90s. If you weren't making money, you weren't getting ahead, you were sinking. And I was living off love offerings of people. And so, as I say, I was poor as dirt, but rich in spirit. And I ended up basically working a couple of jobs. I'd become a social work associate for the state of California, working in a mental health hospital. I did that briefly. Then I became an emergency credentialed teacher working with severely emotionally disturbed, learning handicapped, developmentally disabled kids. That was very, very rewarding. And then I just went really exclusively into the faith healing for a couple of years to the point where it wasn't sustaining me financially. So that's when I created my auction company and my wine and spirits appraisal business. And I thought naively that I could hold on to my spiritual principles. But I think, you know, Sadhguru said it best that, you know, as you start to go down the path of spirituality, eventually you come to a fork in the road, you know? And he said, theoretically, is it possible that you could be in the business world and still be completely focused on the spiritual? Yes. But he says, with great effort and great work. Now, I think that's easier if someone's got a lot of money. But for me, I found that after a couple of years, I really had to focus on work. And then, of course, you know, to use the Hindu term of Maya or illusion, eventually I got lost in that world. And so 30 years later, or a couple of years ago, through a confluence of events, everything, the walls just started coming down, which was horrific at the time, but it, paralleling it, it was the best thing that could ever happen to me. I mean, I would had a relationship that blew up financially. Everything was crumbling around me. I was looking at facing an eviction during the pandemic. And, you know, I literally had thought about suicide several times, but I knew spiritually that I would just be back before I know it and having to go through the same lessons. So I decided that the best thing for me to do, it was just a wake-up call. I joke and I say, you know, I hit rock bottom, but I'd been there a few times before, and I jokingly say that I have a second home there, you know, at the bottom. But when you hit the bottom, there's really only a couple places to go. You either die or you climb back up out of the hole. And that was the epiphany. That was the wake-up call. And so I had that aha moment, that epiphany, and I began praying every day, meditating. And then around that time frame, I had two extraordinary accidents, a car accident and also a significant back injury. And the thought was that, they said the T10 disc had been compromised and that I was facing paralysis, which is basically everything from the waist down, that loss of legs, bowels, bladder, sexual function, the whole thing. And I'm talking with the neurosurgeon, and again, I'd already been praying for a while, and the amount of pain that came from the injuries, Florian, was so bad. It was like someone had poured gasoline on you and threw a match on you. It was like being on fire. The pain, I could not sleep for 4.5 weeks. But that's where my faith got stronger and my belief in Creator. And then, you know, this neurosurgeon says, we need to get you in for emergency surgery. You could be paralyzed at any time. And when he told me this, there was a voice from within me. And that voice said, do not do the surgery now. And I just, that was it. I said, I'm not going to do it. I mean, and this guy was like a car salesman. He's sign the form now, sign the form now. You know, in this country, doctors, they get paid a salary, but they get extra money like selling a car. Every surgery they do, they get more money, right? So they love to cut on you in this country, and they love to make money, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I continued just pursuing this track, and I would like to believe that I'm healing. Although in the last couple of months, I had some really scary experiences, needed some shots of Toradol. It was like I was dragging around a half-dead leg for a while, but I keep overcoming this. And now I'm back to really living a very different life of being in service to others. I'm back to doing healing work with other people, and being a guide. You know, if I can help people or be in service, I'm doing a lot of activist work with Native American causes. And I now have an invitation from my brother on the Arapaho Nation. He's a medicine man, and comes from a lineage of family in his family that's been doing it for hundreds and hundreds of years. And he is also next in line now to be in their nation, the Arapaho Nation, what they call the four old men, which is basically a chief. And there's, I don't know what you call it, you know, a karmic tie, you know, between us, a bond, a real brotherhood. And he wants me, as he says, to come help him do, you know, Native American doctrine or medicine work, as he calls it. He says, I want you to come and do some doctrine with me. And I said, okay, that can happen.
So yeah, one post which caught my attention was the one with Heyoka, very much. And this is also a role, as I have understood, in the indigenous culture. Mm-hmm. And I was asking myself, do I have a Heyoka in me because I'm the pirate? And you said, yeah, there are similarities or parallel mindsets or so. So give us a heads up on what is a Heyoka, and then we can go into what the parallel mindset could be.
So hey, the term Heyoka is actually a Lakota word. Lakota, there's three nations, Lakota, Nakota, and Dakota people, which basically in this country, most Americans just say the Sioux Nation. Mm-hmm. So the Sioux have this word Heyoka. It's also recognized in the Southwest. They call them the Sacred Clown. Or sometimes the trickster, and they're often denoted as having a painted face. And some say in some traditions that they'll ride a horse backwards. Some say they speak backwards. But the Heyoka calling is that typically it's not a choice. It's a calling, and that this occurs by being struck by lightning. And which it just so happens that when I was on Fort Berthold one night praying on a butte in 1994, I got struck by lightning. And now in the Lakota way, beyond that, they have a process that they call dog medicine, which is really the ultimate introduction or way to become Heyoka, which is basically killing a dog. I have reservations about doing that. I won't. I don't believe in taking the life of something for the sake of taking a life. That to me is kind of sounds a lot like the old Bible, the Abrahamic law, sacrifice, you know. But the aspects of Heyoka are that they are true empaths and contrarians. And I had written this article expressing that being Heyoka is a calling, and that it is about people who are empathic, that you understand and feel the emotions of other people. Now, taking that a step further, being a contrarian is not that you live in opposition to society. You're not fighting society. You're not resisting the society. Being a contrarian is that you're just not buying into the societal norms. So you'll find that Heyoka will often be very compassionate, empathetic, empathic people. They tend, especially those that are in the healing arts, you'll find that they tend to be at the right place at the right time. They'll do healing work. The abilities often evolve into other aspects, like what they call weather doctoring or changing the weather, which I can talk a little bit about in a moment, because I have some theories about that that parallel like what Buddhist monks can do and what Hindu yogis can do. And this will hopefully lead into the time that I think we're coming into. But Heyoka is really, it's a calling that in a way takes you out of the material life and really pulls you into the spiritual life. So Heyoka will usually find themselves in occupations like you, like me, that are very different, very unique, or even contrarian. You don't find a lot of people who, for example, are pirates or healers or people that are talking about the Gestalt therapy involved in serious play with Legos, you know, which to me, I think is amazing because, are you there? Because to me, in a way, it's sort of like you're a medicine man for your people. Instead of maybe throwing the runes like the Irish do, you've got Legos, you know? And this aspect is that the Heyoka carries a message that is also very much like the pirate in terms of being free and not wanting to subscribe to the norms or the typical rules of society. Now, sure, traditionally in the past, pirates robbed from others, but in a way, it's kind of no different than like what part of my heritage did in the mafia. You know, the idea was that you're giving back to your family. Yeah. Now, there's ways that we can give back to our family that are legal.
Yeah.
You know, so we give from our heart. We give from our soul. You know, we give our offerings, you know, freely because there's benefit to our fellow man. You know, and there's possibilities still to make a living by being an educator, by speaking. But I definitely found you to be Heyoka because you are very contrarian. You don't find a lot of people like us. I mean, sure, at one time I was the guy in the suit and the tie with the sommelier medals, and I was fucking miserable. You know, it was a fake life. I made a lot of money, but I was miserable. And now when I come to this understanding, it's what do we really need in life to be happy? Not a lot, you know, and happiness really is our state of mind. It's our mindset. It's our heart. And I think the more that we begin to develop spiritually, we start to get messages. And I found that 30 years ago, I had what I call great clarity or vision. My mind's eye was open. I was seeing things, angels, you know, ghosts. And then today I'm hearing things and having visions again, not schizophrenia, not crazy or anything like that, but you're open to the possibility. And the more you open your heart, the lighter you become and the more light shines from you, I think you find that people approach you differently. Some of the biggest lessons that I've learned, I think, are that anger is self-serving. When you think about anger, you can do something destructive to somebody else, and yes, it hurts them, but it does far more damage to you. And anger feeds the ego, which is why it's self-serving. Same thing, fear. What we do to our bodies, the damage that we do to our bodies through holding anger inside, it's no wonder why in Western culture we suffer from so much disease, because we hold on to so much garbage that in indigenous cultures, they let it go. You know, fear. You know, I had this vision the last time that I don't do psychedelics a lot. I know we talked a little bit about this, you and I, but neither sacred medicines that you approach with great reverence and respect. And the last time that I had used sacred medicine, I received a message about fear, and that, just speaking, for example, I'll share one aspect about viruses, that viruses actually do exist, that we can see them under electron microscope, you know, magnified 30,000 times. But think of it as being a dormant seed. what activates a virus or cancer is fear. Fear at its rudimentary level, if we keep feeding it, watering it, giving it fertilizer, food every day, it grows. And when we look at, for example, projecting that out into the world, just look at what's happening in the world today. You know, whether you call it a country, a state, a region, a province, there's so much fear that's feeding these aspects and these ideas that really don't have a basis of why it should be continuing. You know, like when you look at, for example, the skirmishes that are happening and the wars that are happening at the moment, it's like, okay, get over it. You know, I mean, what is really to be accomplished or gained? Now, sure, some politician is going to have something to say, but the point is that what is it actually accomplishing?
Nothing. A lot. No, but it holds us small and under control until we need to free us from that. And that is what we, I think, can also see, that people start doing things which are, it's radicalizing, which I think it is good, because then people feel themselves again, coming back from the dead, let's say. But yeah, they are not that coordinated yet. Yeah, so they are more or less unguided missile. And okay, they are venting. But after that, I think we will find us also in a new era. But for now, I think we tried two big things. It has to split again, like the cells do. If they are getting too big, they split. Mm-hmm. And I'm totally convinced that this is important for the world, that we fragment now, but that also leads us to a much underlying desire of humanity.
You know, Florian, I think if you'll allow me to continue, I have a thought.
Please.
I think that what I felt at the fall of last year, when I was meditating and praying quite a bit, and it's just been getting more and more intense, is that this year would be a very, very different year. And, you know, in this country, we have a lot of religious people, all different religions, you know, from around the world. But Christianity has, in my opinion, in this country, done a lot of damage, because it's often used as a tool of control. And there's a lot of misperception rather than acceptance that what religion really is supposed to do, if you think about it, is supposed to be a bridge to Creator, that gives us a relationship, that's supposed to enhance our relationship with Creator. But instead, sometimes religion is just debased down to rules and a way to subjugate people, which I hate to say, but like the Catholic Church has done for centuries, you know, with indigenous people. And now they're recognizing that and they're making penance. But it's the same thing with Christianity. You know, if you're in the South, the deep South of the U.S., and they talk about the second coming, they keep expecting this man down in a white robe, riding a horse with a crown, a gold crown and a sword. Which, interestingly enough, you know, in Hindu philosophy, if you talk about, and I'll explain the connection here in a minute, in Hindu philosophy, when they talk about the goddess Kali, the divine feminine, she's pictured on a black horse, this semi-blue goddess wearing a gold crown with a sword. And I think a lot of this was created as metaphor to basically, back in the day, hundreds of years ago, to educate those who were illiterate and uneducated. But I think when you come to this time that we're in this year, in Hinduism, the Kali Yuga had passed at the end of January. And for many people, it was a really turbulent time. Our planets and our solar system lined up, but apparently we're at the end of a finger in the galaxy. And apparently we lined up with some other galaxies. And this, in Hindu culture, the Kali Yuga is the end of a period of dark time that's followed by the Satya Yuga, which is the return of Kali. And Kali is known as the liberator of souls. Now, if you come back to Christianity and you think of the second coming, when people ask me, what are your thoughts? I say, well, this is just my opinion, and my opinions are my own, and I'm not here to proselytize, or whatever you want to believe, you believe. And but here's my thought. I think that the second coming is the Christ consciousness, the idea of a consciousness, a mindset that liberates us, much like the return of Kali, a consciousness, the liberator of souls, that part of our evolution from Homo sapiens sapien to, say, the next step is, it's going to happen here, but it's the 12-inch journey that we make from head to heart.
Mm.
And it's going to be here. And I think everybody in this world, doesn't matter your religion, your race, you, everyone, I think, at one time or another touches that Christ consciousness. But in spiritual circles and beliefs today, there's a thought that in Hinduism and in metaphysical circles, which kind of goes back to like what we talked about a little earlier with the Theosophy movement and the Golden Dawn movement that occurred in Germany in the late 1800s, there's this thought that we have 12 dimensions to our body, and that the third, fourth, and fifth dimensional bodies are coming together.
Mm-hmm.
And that when this happens, over, the Hindus say that it will be over a 200-year period. There's some new thought people in the United States that think it will be over a 300-year period, but there's going to be waves and waves of people that in essence start to emerge, if you will, from a spiritual chrysalis, and that these people will be like bodhisattvas. Now, one of my teachers was Ram Dass, who you probably read on my profile, you know, Dr. Richard Alpert, or Jade, and Dr. Richard Alpert was one of the men who dropped acid with Timothy Leary in 1961 at UCLA. He went to India in 1968 or 69, and he met his guru, Neem Karoli Baba, and became enlightened, came back to the US, took the name Ram Dass. Ram Dass, when he would always talk about spirituality, would say, the goal is walk the path and make the path your path to find union with Creator. Now he said, you know, along the way, you may have a Kundalini experience, you may have a mystical experience or experience some mystical power, but he says, don't focus on that. That those are the light posts on the side of the path that illuminate the path. But the goal isn't the light, the lamp post. The goal is the union with Creator. And I think that this period that we're in, when they're talking about these, the joining of these bodies, third, fourth, and fifth dimensional selves, they said that you may start to notice things that happen around you that may seem odd or like poltergeist type of experience. You know, for example, in the room behind me, I was talking to a friend one night and a book on the bookshelf came out and starts flapping. And I thought a chipmunk or a squirrel had got into the house, and it stopped when I looked, and then it started again. My friend says, go pick up the book. Go pick up the book. God damn it. And I went and I picked up the book, and it was some poetry book by a British author, an American author. And I said, oh, that's not it. And then I meditated here on my recliner later, and the voice said, go look at the book. So I picked the next book down, and I look at it, and I said, son of a bitch. And it was Ram Dass, Journeys to Awakening. The book Journeys to Awakening by Ram Dass. And I said, well, that's a message. That's powerful. And so kind of coming back to this whole Heyoka concept, as we evolve spiritually, the idea is don't seek power or don't try to use your abilities, because that's just like playing a magic trick and it's self-serving. It doesn't do anything. But if you're using your abilities to benefit humankind to say whether it's healing or you get a message, a prophetic message that has benefit for mankind. That's the intention that I think Creator strengthens us or empowers us to use. So like when you look at a Hindu yogi who say might be able to levitate, they actually had a book several hundred years ago called Patanjali's Sutras, which defined that there were 1400 mystical powers that humans could develop or utilize. But the idea is take that book, throw it over your shoulder, because it's not about the powers. It's that when you see these monks giving a blessing to someone, you wonder, wow, I just witnessed something that defies the laws of physics. How did they do this? You know, or you see a Buddhist monk who is able to traverse a mountain. You know, there's Sherpas up at the top of a mountain, and here's this guy 2 miles down, 3 miles down, you know, and he has to walk a 3,000 foot pitch, which would take a couple of hours, and he does it in minutes, you know, and you say, how did that happen? Or the Heoka, who a ceremony's going on and a rainstorm comes, and he pushes the storm out of the way. Well, how did that happen? People say these are miracles. They defy the laws of physics. And I say, no. When you think about miracles or magic, there's two kinds of power. The power of will or willpower is an act of will. And that drains you because you're not connected to Creator. That even at its worst is what you would call black magic or witchcraft. But when you are connected to Creator and you're using God's energy for the benefit of humankind, it's not that you're defying the laws of physics. It's that, like, for example, with Heoka, you are completely at one with nature, with Mother Earth, with the universe. So if a rainstorm moves, it's not that you're using willpower to make it move. It's that you are absolutely at one with the Creator at that time. And you're working with that energy, not in opposition, but in complete balance with it. So as a result of your consciousness, nature has to correspond and follow. And it's the same thing, in essence, with healing work. Is healing work isn't willing, you know, a tumor to go away. It's knowing in consciousness the truth about the person that you work with, that that person is perfect, healthy, and whole. And that person is a demonstration of God's consciousness in them. And when you recognize and you see and you believe that consciousness and you know that truth, that there is only perfection in that person, it demonstrates. It has no choice but to demonstrate. That consciousness is reflected. This, I think, is part of, if you will, the phrase that we often hear, you know, in the Bible or read, is heaven is a place here on earth. As a kid, I'll tell you, and into my 20s, I said, oh, that's a bunch of fucking bullshit. But now I understand that, you know, everything is consciousness. That, you know, when you think about it, consciousness takes you where you need to go and what you need to experience. So yes, are there people who live in Bangladesh or in Calcutta that are living miserable lives? Yes. Well, sure. If you ask them on a human level, would you like to live somewhere else? Well, yeah, who wouldn't? I mean, hell, I'm starving here. I haven't had a bath in 2 days. But consciousness and also our soul and the lessons brings us into a place in the world, because in a three-dimensional reality, we learn our lessons faster. That's the possibilities, the by being a possibilitist, or as you called it. Yeah. Our consciousness can ultimately free us too, and can literally change, just as the Hindus say, you know, your karma can change in the blinking of an eye. And it really is true that consciousness can either imprison you or it can free you. And most of my life, I say openly, my consciousness has imprisoned me. And I'm just getting to a place where I'm understanding what consciousness is and how powerful it is, because consciousness is also the key to freeing you and to also helping others.
Yeah, let me jump in here. Thanks for this journey, because now is the question, how do you integrate that in your life? Because you're coming from somewhere, you had your confluence with, like, let's say a clusterfuck, which was a wake-up call. Hello, Tom, it's us. you can continue if you want, but there is also another option. Okay, new option. Okay, I choose that one. And then a lot of things are happening. I mean, you said, okay, your relationship you had, I don't know, ended. And also, like, your environment, I mean, they are used to a Tom who is the man with all the wine appraisal, maybe with the I mean, okay, COVID helped maybe to make your change, but there is the wine appraisal Tom still, and there is a business guy Tom, and now you have this healing part. And how do you get these things together, and how is your environment reacting to it?
Well, you know, that's a great question. Again, my mantra over the last 2 years has been, I surrender. I surrender. It's not that I'm giving up. It's not that I'm quitting. It's that I'm totally going into flow consciousness. So I hadn't worked in almost a year, and I have an appraisal assignment that I'm working on now. And it was funny because the insurance company wanted me to do this, that, the other thing. And I said, you know, you really don't need me to do this. The statute of limitations in terms of legal law in California had expired for this guy. And I said, you don't need to hire me. You're wasting your money. They said, well, we want to hire you. We want to pay you. At that point, I said, okay, I'm not going to refuse money, but I'm telling you, it's a waste of time. It's a waste of your money. You really don't need my report, but we want to do it. Well, okay, this is creator saying, I'm going to give you some money. And, you know, so as far as business, you know, like I say, I made a commitment 2 years ago to become what's called a renunciate, which is used more often in India. In other words, I no longer pursue materialism or self-aggrandizement. So in other words, if work comes to me or opportunities to, say, educate, you know, and to be a speaker come, I take them. If someone asks me to do healing work, I don't charge for that. It's a love offering. It's what you feel compelled to give, because healers are not supposed to charge. So if I get wine and spirits appraisal work, I accept that, because I can do that well into the rest of my life. But what I see happening is that our world is changing dramatically. And I think you had mentioned about 10 minutes ago or so, this energy on the planet. What I thought going into this year was that this was going to be a very, very powerful year. And it is. And both energies, negative and positive, are rising. And unfortunately, in Western culture, we tend to focus more on the negative. So we see things like what's happening right now with Israel and Gaza, and we see what's happening in the Ukraine, and we look at other events around the world, and we hear about political news, like with Trump and the scandals. And yeah, it's like, okay, so there's all this negativity, but there's also a lot of positive things that are happening right now that are changing sympathies and empathies within people. But we tend to focus less on the positive. And I think that part of what is happening for me is, when I made the decision to become a renunciate, I'm more about, what is it that I can do to serve my fellow human being? What is it that I can do to help? So that's where I've been doing a lot of activist work with Native American groups. I've also been doing healing work with people, which scared the hell out of me, because the other thing, I mean, that I feel, which I think we all feel this at times, you're familiar with the term imposter syndrome. mm-hmm. you know, where we doubt our yeah. abilities, yeah. we doubt what we are capable of doing. And when it comes to the healing work, every single time I'm asked, there's always this fear, this doubt. And then I have to just close my eyes and say, you have nothing to fear, because it's not you doing the work. I'm just a vessel. I'm a channel. It's mm-hmm. Creator doing the work. And it's also the same thing with this power, or this process of surrender. Is what I found for 30 years was that most of what was going on was that I was going against the grain of the wood, or I was fighting the river. I was trying to swim up current. And now what I find is that by releasing and surrendering and really, truly going into flow consciousness, I find that my path is becoming a lot less challenging, because there's fewer obstructions. There's fewer log jams, if you will, because I'm just really going where I need to go. So with business, yes, there is still a business aspect, but basically when people say, what are you doing now? I say, I'm a renunciate. I'm a healer. Mm. I'm helping my fellow human beings.
And how do they react? So what is the reaction, or how is your like your friends? I mean, did the friend field also change, or I mean,
great question.
How are you, like, where is your belonging? Did that change?
Absolutely. It's funny how this works. You know, you've heard this phrase. The Japanese have done a study, for example, with water. Various jars of water, mm-hmm. some that have some contaminants in it. What they found is that if they prayed over the water, or they felt the feeling of love, the contaminants in the water disappeared. And yes. you've heard this phrase also, where if you take, for example, a jar of water and you put a drop of ink in it, it muddies the water. But if you keep putting good drops of water into the jar, eventually the whole jar changes and becomes good. Mm-hmm. To me, this is the idea where every one of us, it doesn't matter what you've done in the past. We've all done bad things. I've done a lot of things I'm not proud of. And I've suffered the consequences. I've made a lot of bad decisions. But what I realized ultimately is that we also have the ability to be redeemed. We're always forgiven. But the bigger blessing, for example, is that when you start to let go of anger, you start to feel, that came in another journey, a psychedelic journey, where we hold anger in our bodies and how damaging it is. That can be freeing when you start to let go of anger. Now, we will always be human beings. We will always have ego. It's hardwired in our DNA. We will always have fight or flight. But it's when we use ego in excess that really damages us. And as we let anger go, we start to heal. And then when we start to learn about forgiveness, it's not just that Creator forgives us, but it's when we start to forgive ourselves, then all of a sudden a whole other world opens up. And then pretty soon, if you follow Hindu tradition with chakras or energy points like Oriental medicine, you start to change, and you change at an energetic level, and your body in essence becomes like a battery, if you will. And you start to find that the more that you're going with flow, and the more that you are in sync with Creator, the more good that tends to come from you, you know. And at the same time, you're still a human being, you know. There are going to be people out there that are stupid, that are going to do stupid things, and you're going to get pissed off. Like, all you have to do is get in your car and drive, and there's some fucking moron doing something stupid. And I'll say that, like, oh, yeah, fucking moron. Oh, wait a minute. Okay, come on, forgive them, you know. But that's the human condition. We will always be human. We will always make mistakes. We're never going to be perfect. It's good to have goals to try to better ourselves. But more importantly, with forgiveness, it also comes down to this whole idea also, like they talk about in psychology, guilt versus shame. And in this country, we often confuse the two. Do you know what the difference is, Florian, between guilt or shame?
I mean, Brené Brown makes a good definition for us, but I couldn't quote her right now. But you have, you're ready.
Well, guilt, the difference between guilt and shame, which a lot of people intermix and they don't understand, is guilt is knowing when you've done something wrong. That's potentially hurt someone else or hurt you. Shame is the false belief that you're a bad person. And shame can be, again, an introject that we adopt at childhood from our parents or through a number of circumstances. But even the way shame itself, like anger or fear or doubt, shame can also create tremendous imbalance in the physical body. For example, specifically, shame impacts a person's pancreas. And unfortunately, you'll often find that victims of sexual abuse will often have pancreatic or endocrine system issues. And it because people, again, more indigenous cultures figure this out, but as we come back into balance, we start to purge and let things go. And like when you talked about people and how does this impact your friends, for 30 years, when I was lost, there were a few people I could talk about spirituality with, but you can't really talk about it publicly because then people think, okay, this guy is, or, you know, he's nuts. But I just got to a point where I said, I don't care. Yeah. I'm doing my own thing.
And then who
is walking by you? You looked up.
Yeah, there was the neighbor. The neighbor was just crossing by and I wasn't sure if I should wave, you know, and I didn't. So I missed the chance of having a positive impact of connecting. Yeah.
Well, you smile.
But I smiled. I mean, I smiled. Yes. At least.
That's good.
You were talking a lot of about humanity and also the human level of how we are. But you're a man, and you said you're coming from a patriarchal environment on both sides, Irish and Sicilian. And so, where's the man, Tom? What's your status of being a man? Have you really just got rid of it because you're human and this is gender free? where's the man?
I still get most of my life people have looked at me and said, I'm an alpha male, I've always been kind of an alpha male. I'm still an alpha male. And part of my background, my training, is also being a first responder, which is, problem solution. I still get upset. I cry. I still feel lust. I still like to drink a glass of wine. I enjoy a good meal. I like to get laid just like everybody else. I'm not trying to be something that I'm not. I'm a man living in this world, and I am trying to embrace and live a spiritual life as a man. And again, I think this is also where, there's, when we look at literature through history, there's a term you're probably familiar with it called the hero's journey.
Yeah. Gestalt therapy, the hero's journey. Yes. Yeah. Been there, done that.
Yes, exactly. And, and it's funny because, I have another brother who has German roots like you, and he's down in South Africa. You might be connected to him. Das Lion or Das Leon?
No.
He's also doing visionary work and mystic work down in South Africa. And he takes people on tours and walkabouts. And really cool guy. I hope to connect with him in person one of these days. But the man, you know, I understand, and it was made really clear to me again in a vision. I had a message during a journey, a psychedelic journey, from Michael and also Mother Earth and Archangel Gabriel, and I have a guide, Golden Eagle, and they were all there. And the message was, Tom, don't try to be perfect, because you never will be. Give that up and you'll save yourself a lot of time and grief. It's not possible in this third dimensional reality. They also said that ego is hardwired again in your DNA. It gives you fight or flight response, but as you know, ego in excess can be very detrimental. And they said, you know, and then Michael stepped forward like a father admonishing a son and holding his index finger. And he said, you know, you're a very intelligent man, Tom. And when you were young, you lorded your intelligence over other people. You were arrogant. You were condescending. You were full of yourself, selfish. And he said, no, that ideally, of course, if you could have unconditional love for everyone, wouldn't that be great? But he says, even we as angels know that that is not always possible. But know that when you look into the eyes of every woman or man that you come across, that you're no greater than or no less than. And that if you can't love them, try to be completely present with them. And it will be disarming by just being empathetically present. And, you know, truthfully, it's still a challenge because I'm in this place of great transition. I'm not perfect. I'm trying to be more spiritual. But again, you know, people do things. I get pissed off. I react. But I find that these days I'm less reactionary. I try more to take a deep breath before I respond. I think about my words because, again, in Native American tradition, words have power. And when you release your words, you can't take them back. No. So, but I have found also that I had a very powerful vision 30 years ago. I'm still not quite sure what it means, but I had another vision recently that I wanted to share with you, because again, when I talked about these two energies ramping up, this happened and I felt this right after the solar eclipse. I said, we're going to start to witness events on this planet that are negative and positive, and that these are going to continue to ramp up because it's taking us to a place where ultimately we're either going to change or we won't. And when people ask me, well, like, how do you explain the convergence of these three-dimensional bodies? And I say, well, this gets into maybe a concept of multiverses or parallel realities, but imagine, Florian, that you're in a room talking to 100 people and all 100 people are interacting, and then you blink your eyes and you look in the room and now there's maybe only 35 people. And then those 65 people are in the room and they blink their eyes and now they can't figure out where the 35 people are. You're still in the same room. You're still on the same planet in the same, you know, timeline, but in a different world. The idea is that as our consciousness progresses, this may be how the world ends up changing, that certain people who choose to be in a more dense consciousness will find themselves in that world, and people that are lightening up their consciousness are evolving, find themselves in a different world. I think that when you look at now what the Hindus say is the Kali, or the Satya Yuga, and the return of Kali, I think this all comes down to consciousness. And I think that our consciousness is most definitely changing. But living in a three-dimensional reality on a physical plane, as opposed to, say, being an angelic, where you're in a more perfected state, in a more perfected environment, you know, higher energy and different beings from other realms, they can come here temporarily, but eventually their energy vibrates at such a level that it brings them back. But at a physical level, and back to your question about like the man, what I'm finding over this last couple of years is that, yes, I've let a lot of people go. There's been a lot of toxic relationships that are gone. But interestingly enough, like putting the good water in the jar, all these other people, the people that leave, all of a sudden there's these openings and there's all these other people coming in. And those are people that I'm finding it. At first I thought it was a miracle, but I realized, no, it's not a miracle. It's consciousness that I'm attracting people. You're attracting people that were resonating and vibrating at the same level in consciousness. And there's a reason for that because, you know, like the old phrase that you hear in America goes, you know, water finds its own level. It's really, really true. You know, And I think in that vein, it's just like if you go to an ashram and you pray, the vibration is at a much higher level versus if you go to a bar, there's a lowest common denominator vibration. Mm-hmm. But I think what's happening on this planet is there are people that are now millions of souls, I think, are starting to change consciously. And we're seeing evidence of this. Like, look at LinkedIn. You know, whether it's regeneration, rewilding, soil, food security, food insecurity, spirituality, renewable energy, green energy, solar energy. I mean, pick the topic. There's people out there on a mission, and all of this is positive. And yes, of course. And then you see the flip side on LinkedIn, you know, which is someone being an idiot. Well, that's okay. You know, I mean, but the idea is that I think as our consciousness is going to continue to help us to evolve, and in essence, I think whether or not there is such a thing as utopia or whether or not we find that in this life, I don't know. But I think that our consciousness does place us where we need to be. And I think, you know, I know from my own experience, when my consciousness wasn't good, I was in circumstances that I really didn't like, you know, and that as my consciousness expands, I find myself more and more in circumstances that I want to be in and in an environment that I want to be in.
Do you think we as men have now to catch up because our female friends like made it faster or were like more educating themselves in the last 50 years? Is it now the man's turn?
Are you talking about like women's
spirituality? I mean the spirituality. I mean if I can talk with women easily about spirituality in any case and fast. But I really need to find the guy on the bar to talk about spirituality. I mean, first I have to go through beer, football, and whatever. But then maybe we land, on a rock bottom that he's not happy, and what could help? And it's not the spirits behind the bar. I mean, yes, somehow, but.
You know, that's very interesting because, you know, again, in Western culture, the paradigm is men don't show their feelings. You know, the classic example, you know, of being a man is strong, silent, you don't show your feelings. But, you know, some of us, like you and I, we broke free of that paradigm, you know. There's a phrase, for example, I always found this fascinating, and for years, decades, actually, a couple of decades, I always tried to figure out what this meant. And I realized, you know, I'm in a generation of what are called generation breakers, meaning that I'm doing things far differently than my parents did or their parents before them. And so I first heard this phrase in the early 1980s, you know, the biblical phrase, the sins of the father are passed on to the son and unto the seventh generation. Have you ever heard that phrase?
Yeah.
Well, you know, when you think about a generation, that's 20 years is a generation. And when you say the sins of the father are passed unto the son and unto the seventh generation, that's 140 years. And today, when you watch documentaries about either artisans or people, older cultures, you know, like in Eastern Europe, well, why are you planting this way? Or why? Well, my father did it this way. Well, why did he do it that way? Well, because that's what his father taught him. And the same thing happens with negative habits, that we often make the same mistakes that our parents did because that's what we learned. And when you look at, you know, some of the authors, for example, like in the 1980s, like Robert Bly and the Iron John books, they talked about breaking the ties that bond. And, you know, when I think about my own example and the father that I had, which is really a father that no man would want, you know, I used to hate him and I used to think about killing him. And then I finally, and it's only been in the last year, where I got to a place of forgiveness. And I had to get to that a couple of times. I had to keep coming back to it because then I'd find I was getting in a rage. It's like, oh, that motherfucker. And then I got to a place even beyond forgiveness where I said, again, it was an epiphany. It was an aha moment of, you know, he was a messenger. And I couldn't get to where I am today spiritually had I not gone through all these lessons. So when you talk about the differences also with men and women, there are obviously there's the physiological differences. There's, you know, obviously the morphology of a man versus a woman. We still like to procreate. Men have a stronger urge, but women have the receptivity, you know, and that divine feminine. And so, yes, when men are able to also get in touch with their femininity or their divine feminine, the left side versus the masculine, the right side, then you're not necessarily seen as a man or an aggressor. You're seen as someone who's an equal, you know. And I think that also gets into the concept of like the Native American warrior philosophy is that, you know, warriors were very balanced, you know, they could defend the tribe, but at the same time they could come back and they would assist the women or play with the children, and it was very balanced. But when you think about even today in Native American reservations, for example, in the United States, there's a huge amount of dysfunction which tends to be continuous and ongoing. And a lot of that also deals with the governmental policy. So, you know, like all aspects of society, you know, you can take any group and you'll find good people, bad people, you'll find drug addiction, you'll find, you know, lower education rates. But a lot of that is also, especially on Native American reservations, it's done by design, I think, through governmental policy and bureaucracy. But as a male or a female on this planet in a world made up of many races, many cultures, many civilizations, I think, again, Western culture, we've tended to create the separation in the wall between the sexes, whereas you don't find that, for example, as much in indigenous culture. There's more of a union and a balance because it's not codependence, it's an interdependence. And I've been fortunate enough, you know, to travel around to parts of the world to personally experience and to see this. But yet, you know, in Western culture, we don't have that. And I think, again, what I find very interesting, you've probably seen this in a couple of my posts, but there's the Hopi prophecy for America from the Hopi Indians. And you might remember back in the early 80s, there was a film called Koyaanisqatsi with the soundtrack from Philip Glass. It's Koyaanisqatsi is a Hopi Indian word that means life out of balance, which is then followed by Apoiskatsi, which is life at war, before it goes to back to Lakoiiskatsi. or maybe I had Lacoya-Scotzi and Powys-Scotzi mixed up, but one of the Lacoya-Scotzi's Life Out of Balance, which then goes to Life at War, which then goes back to Life at Balance. Mm-hmm. And the Hopi had a prophecy for America that goes back hundreds of years, that basically they said this country will cease to exist. That in other words, the land will be here, there will be people here, but there will be a great change and a great shift. And I remember in this post, I put it up, it was filmed by Scandinavian Television 35 years ago. They interviewed Floyd Red Crow Westerman, a Hopi elder, and he talked about this prophecy. And when you look at this film from 35 years ago from Scandinavian Television, you say, holy moly, this has all come to pass and we're in this right now. And he basically said, those who live the Indian way will survive. Now, that's a broad generalization, but what I think you can take from that spiritually and significantly is it's this idea that most of the world today we've contaminated with false beliefs about Western ideals and materialism. You know, that, for example, when I was in the Peace Corps in the Eastern Caribbean, a lot of the people that I was there to help were always talking about, look, I've got a plasma television. Look, I bought a washer and dryer. Isn't this great? And I'm thinking, oh my God, no, this isn't good. You're in paradise. You know, I met an old man on the beach. I mean, his philosophy was great. I talked with him. He had the biggest smile. He's got three fish on a line. And I shook his hand and I said, what do you do? He says, well, I fish. I said, see that. And he says, each day I go out. He says, someday I catch only one fish, someday I catch seven. I come back. He says, I pass the bar, which in the Caribbean, all the bars are blue shacks, teal shacks. I trade a fish. I get a couple of beers. I go to the market. I trade a fish or two. I get some rice, vegetables. I go home. I eat fish with vegetables and rice, and I have a beer or two. And then what do you do the next day? I go fish. You know, so it's this whole, or like the Buddhist philosophy, chop wood, carry water. You know, well, what do you do when you become enlightened? Well, every day I go out and I chop wood and I carry water. Mm. You know, it's like, what really changes? I mean, the idea is that we have created these false beliefs that we need to drive the Bentley. We need to have the house in the Hollywood Hills, you know. We need to have all this money. We need to have the latest and greatest, this and that. And then I asked some of these people, and I've known them. I mean, in the wine world, as a charity auctioneer, I used to do the Jackson Hole Wine Auction, the Horse Press Weekend of Wine in Arizona. I met millionaires, billionaires, royalty. They're all miserable. They're fucking miserable people. You know, well, what makes you happy? You know, and that they're always will give you some excuse, you know, but you know, to me, people now I think are starting to wake up to this idea of less is more. You know, I don't need to drive a Mercedes-Benz. I don't need to have a massively huge house. I don't need to have more than one house or more than one vehicle. I just need really to be at peace, you know, with myself and with the world around me. And what I'm also finding with this present time, which is interestingly enough, because I've been asking a lot of people, is the energy is ramping up almost to a point, in my opinion, that there's like a frenetic characteristic and an agitation almost. Have you noticed that?
That?
Have you noticed that the energy is really ramping or increasing? And it's almost like agitating, you know, it creating a disturbance, if you will, in the force. Hmm. You know, there's a disturbance in the force. I think that part of that is prompting us to look within more and to want to change. You know, some people, and again, consciousness takes you where you will. Like, I would never live in Los Angeles for all the rice in China. I would never live in LA. I wouldn't live in San Francisco. I wouldn't live in Chicago. To me, it reminds me, as a kid, I was in a pet store. Mm-hmm. They had a bunch of rats in an aquarium, a 10-gallon aquarium, and they had litters of little rats. And then I saw this, and it was the most horrific thing, because a couple of the big rats were walking over the little rats. They didn't have any care or any empathy, even though they were their young. And then I watched these rats eating the young. And that impression in my life of seeing this as a kid has never left my mind. But to me, it's also this idea of the pressure cooker. You know, so many people think that live out in a rural area, oh, my dream is to go live in the big city. Have fun. You know, go with my blessings, please. But I'm finding, much like the Heoka, I'm more in this process of give me quiet, give me peace. Right now, I'm, you know, living on Whidbey Island in Washington State. There's 110 islands. I live in a very rural island. I am likely going to be moving somewhere to the Midwest and to Indian country in the next year or two.
Okay.
And I'm going to be happy. Much happier. How about you?
Yeah. How about me? Okay. That would be the other 90 minutes from now. But it's your stage. It's your stage, Tom. Yeah, let me come to the last two questions, because you already somehow answered it. But what would be like the wishes for yourself in the next time coming?
Probably first and foremost to be happier. Most of, you know, obviously you don't know me that well, and most people who know me who have familiarity with my life kind of compare it to the story of Job in the Bible.
Okay.
You know, I mean, if it could happen, it did happen. And most of my life, truthfully, when people have asked, are you happy? I used to lie. Oh yeah, I'm happy. It's not to say that I haven't experienced moments of joy or pleasure. I think when I was in my 20s and I was doing the faith healing work, that was a period where I was probably the happiest that I had been. But my life then was still like a warped 33 1/3 record, because I hadn't gotten over the childhood, you know, traumas or healed from that. But now I'm finding, as I've been dealing with those traumas and letting things go and forgiving and getting over anger, that happiness is coming in. And I'm finding that the opportunities that are coming to me are not necessarily the opportunities, if you will, that will make you wealthy monetarily, but they're making me wealthy in spirit. For example, my connection to you, your connection to me, contributes to me, to my psyche, you know, and to my spirituality. And then you are also sharing my experience with your audience, which now opens up Europe, you know. And I'm finding that there's other people that I'm connecting with spiritually that were doing things that are not necessarily financially about benefit. They help people. And I find that the more that I'm doing for other people, the happier I feel. So I'm doing also a lot of charity work besides activist work. I do some work with some charities that benefit seniors, senior citizens, or elders. And I think happiness is probably trying to have more of that in my life than I've ever had. You know, trying to smile more, which I'm doing, and I never really did before. So I guess that's one question.
Yeah. So the last question is, what would you wish for the world?
Well, the first phrase that came to my mind was wake the fuck up. Yeah. But now making it a little bit more polite, wake the fuck up. Yeah. I mean,
we love.
What's that?
Yeah, you can say it with love. I mean, wake the fuck up.
Right. Lovingly. I mean, I would guess, you know, it's, again, this kind of comes back. The only way I can really frame this is when you look at this country, the United States, we have 342,346,000 people here, and 110 million of them are taking some kind of psychotropic medication, which that has to tell you something. A third of the country is basically masking their system, their symptoms. You know, I'm going to take Zoloft, or I'm going to take this, you know, serotonin reuptake inhibitor. I'm going to take this. I'm going to take something to help me sleep. Because they're living out of balance. And I guess if I had a message to the world, it would be, don't be afraid to look within. Don't be afraid to face your demons. There are those of us out there that are here to help you. And that if you really want to change, it's not easy. It can be really scary. It can be tremendously scary. But there are people that will help you to help yourself. Because in essence, really, I guess the final phrase that I would say would be, the greatest gift that we give to the world is the gift of our own personal transformation.